Orb, Volume 1, Number 12. Entitlement. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. You walk into a store and look around. Not finding just what you're looking for, you want to ask for some assistance. Behind the counter is a clerk talking on the phone. You walk over and look expectantly for acknowledgement. The clerk continues the conversation, which you quickly discern is a personal call about who said what to whom at a party last night. You wait. The phone conversation continues. You shift your weight from one foot to the other, look about, tap your fingers. The phone call continues to a natural conclusion, whereupon the clerk turns to you and says, "Hello, how can I help you?" Your patience is worn pretty thin, and you have to bite your lip to avoid saying something you might regret. Here's another story, and it's true. When I was in high school, I had a part-time job at a large department store. At the time, there was a labor dispute between teachers and the province, who were suggesting they would legislate a settlement. I supported the teacher's side and took to wearing a black armband. I would tell people that it was my expression of mourning at the loss of respect for teachers. When I showed up at work wearing the armband, my department manager contacted Human Resources and they politely asked that I remove it. They explained that while I was working, I was an agent of the store, and therefore I was not at liberty to express my personal views in this way. I understood and respected their position and removed the armband. While on the company's time, I am in their service. I have an expectation that my personal life must come second to the duty I have to my employer. My entitlement to personal expression is suspended because, while they pay me, it is my duty to represent the company to the customers. Honestly, I have to admit that while I was working in a high-tech office environment, I had an expectation that I could engage in some personal activities on company time. Most people assume they can use some work resources for personal activities. It used to be using the photocopier on something not work-related. Now it's using the internet, email, or a company's cell phone for personal business. And of course, helping yourself to the occasional few office supplies. There is a spectrum of permitted personal use of company resources. Some establishments, like sweatshops, don't allow any. Most are fairly lenient. Pushing this far enough, you can reach an extreme that results in disciplinary action. If you accept the reprimand and adjust your expectations to your employer's tolerance, you're in the majority, and the old culture. If, on the other hand, you resent the discipline, you are in the new culture that holds a sense of entitlement. Who are they to tell you what you can and can't do with your time and their resources, even if it is the time you sold them for pay? There is a growing perception that a new generation is unwilling to adjust their expectations. They have a sense of entitlement that their own activities and interests are never set aside, even for those they are expected to serve. It irritates older people, like me. In this episode, I want to look at where that culture of entitlement comes from, and what harm it can do, and why I'm irritated by it. Let's start with some revelations from the book Campus Confidential, 100 Startling Things You Don't Know About Canadian Universities. One of the authors, Ken Coates, a professor and former dean at the University of Waterloo, spoke with Anna Maria Tremonti on the CBC radio program The Current.
Ken, you call today's university students the entitlement generation. Describe some ways in which you feel students are displaying entitlement.
High expectations about work that will actually be, that they'll get the high grades they were used to in high school, that will respond to them instantly when they send an email, that if they don't get the grade they want, that we'll let them rewrite their paper, let them rewrite their examination, that they'll come at us over and over and over again, and sometimes, you know, bring their parents with them as well to sort of press their point. I mean, young people expect that the world will unfold the way we as parents and a society promised they would.
Ken Coates makes several key points. One of the most important is that the expectations that lead to entitlement were created by the cultural messaging of the previous generation. It's not the new generation's fault that they believe they deserve more than they are getting. Still, it frustrates everyone that they cling to that entitlement. Consider this comment from a student at the University of Alberta in Edmonton.
And as far as being late, the profs just need to get their panties out of a knot with us coming in late, a minute late or whatever. They need to chill, because it's not like the most important part of their lesson is 5 minutes in.
Although not admitting it openly, this is a claim that they are entitled to disrespect others. That's the part I find irritating. It also indicates a misunderstanding of how learning, really coming to understand something, is built from pieces. It is a journey from where you know you are to a new place. The things at the beginning are the starting points and the first steps to reaching the important ideas that are at the end of the road.
I could understand that we may seem lazy because we're late for class or we don't do as much work, it seems, as the older generations. However, you have to realize that we do have a whole new set of technology that we can take advantage of. I know personally, that's my goal, is to succeed with the least amount of effort. But I don't think it's really a product for a new generation, more of we're trying to beat the system. Do everything as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible.
I'll settle for students being late. I have real trouble with students not coming at all. And one of the things we talk about is it's not uncommon for professors in certain classes, in many classes actually, to have, you know, 30-40% of the students not coming to a particular course. But, you know, you can't learn very much from your professor if you're not in class. And the idea that you're going to go pick it up on Wikipedia or on the websites and what have you, you know, some students do, but an awful lot don't.
Emma Godmere, the National Bureau Chief for Canadian University Press, responded.
These works that we are expected to read in school, I think potentially they are still from a different time. I mean, you know, in the media, we're always talking about catering to online readership and whatnot. And I think in academic reading and in the media, more people need to cater to that younger audience. And I know that might sound like it's coming from the entitlement generation.
We're not going to cater to that. You want a sort of a Thomas Aquinas for Dummies kind of approach. And you didn't say that, Emma, so I apologize. But in fact, you can't cater. You know, when you're talking about the great thoughts, the great ideas, the great important things to study, you have to consume the material. There's no other way around it. But you end up with this reality that you know, students don't get to choose this stuff. You got these great ideas, you got these great things you want to teach, and the students either aren't there, or else they are doing their laptops in the back row, or they haven't done the reading. And you have 10, 15, 20% who are tremendously engaged. Those students are just as frustrated with the rest of them as the professors are.
Emma, what do you think?
When you've got 17, 18-year-olds, going to these lecture halls and being expected to read a lot, I agree with Ken that, I mean, a lot of these are necessary. A lot of these readings are necessary for the degrees that they're pursuing, absolutely. But maybe we are putting a lot of pressure on these young kids to go after this.
Is 18 that young? I'm sorry, is 18 that young to be in university?
We actually have a chapter in the book that we call 18 is the new 15.
And so are you saying maybe they shouldn't be there?
Absolutely.
Emma, what do you think of that? Do you think there's a pressure for people to think they have to go to university when they really don't want to?
Absolutely. I think we need to be talking more about college options, apprenticeship options, and taking gap years and taking time off for work. I think, I don't know whose responsibility it is. Again, perhaps it comes down to the parents, it comes down to high schools, but we do need to be having definitely more discussion about other options, because I think this idea that university campuses, that's the only place you have to go once you graduate high school, that's wrong on so many levels.
Entitlement, like racism, is learned. The entitlement generation were taught what to expect and that it was non-negotiable. It is an entitlement. The older generation has delivered them here. If where they've ended up is not where they expected to be, they won't accept it, and they won't go back and walk the path themselves. They want to be dropped off at the door of their desired destination.
Everyone just feels entitled to high marks without actually doing any work to it, and they don't ever put in the proper amount of effort to get the success that they think they deserve. They just demand better marks because they aren't happy with the ones they have, not for any particular reason. And there's not a sense of responsibility when they do things wrong.
You talk about entitlement, that they demand more marks, so they expect to be graded more. So when you give them a bad grade, when you say you've handed this in late, so I'm going to give you a penalty, what's the reaction?
Well, in some ways, it's persistence. You know, you'll have, and this, be honest too here, this is not every single student, but these are the ones who are more energetic about this. I guess the ones where students come directly to me as the dean's office because a professor decided not to give them the grade they thought they deserved, with a mother actually in this instance sort of claiming that she'd proofread the paper and the professor was wrong to grade it for grammatical consistency. And, and accuracy. So you get these ideas that the students will go right to the top very, very quickly, that they'll complain quite ferociously, they'll appeal their grades, they'll appeal the examination results that they've received.
Perhaps that's not the worst thing. Haven't we been taught to stand up for ourselves and fight for what we believe is right? If we want to go back to what we've been taught in elementary school and high school, I think our generation has been taught that if you don't think something's right, you stand up and at least you speak out at the very least. So maybe we should be appreciating that more. I'm not sure. A sense of entitlement, I think there is something to be said for the fact that maybe we are being treated a bit too generously in high school.
Do you see this as a problem with students, or do you see this as a problem with both the parents and the teachers who get students ready for university?
I think the latter at this point. Even just this discussion alone has shown that obviously there are issues with our schooling systems if we're preparing students for disaster, as Ken put it, once we graduate from university.
There is a tendency to lay some of the blame for our culture of entitlement on a shift in how we guard the self-esteem of our children. It's as if a disappointed child will be scarred for life and grow into a psycho killer. They don't. Sadness, disappointment, and shame pass. Kids learn. They grow. Trees have stood against storms because they have grown resilience and flexibility. These are important qualities in people, too. Shielding people from storms does not make us grow stronger. It makes us grow brittle. In Episode 9 on failure, I spoke of how managing our expectations was important in judging failure. Failure can be disappointing, sometimes devastating. It is also the source of much of our learning and growth. Failure is essential to healthy development. Dressing up failure with participation ribbons and hiding it behind compliments on our effort is, to an extent, to deny us an opportunity to grow. If there is something we are all entitled to, it is to become the best we can be. That also means we are entitled to fail. And fail we do. There are still pressures on kids at school, particularly with the advent of standardized testing. When testing stopped being about measuring the relative success of our kids and became about measuring the success of our systems and institutions, we really put the pressure on. There must be something else going on that has delivered us to this place where people are coming to expect something for nothing. Consider the state of things in the Western world about 300 years ago. Your sense of entitlement and your expectations were governed by the class into which you were born. The majority in the working poor never expected to rise to the level of luxury enjoyed by the landed gentry. Quite literally, entitlement depended on having a title. Then came the liberty, equality, and fraternity of the French and American revolutions. A new era was upon us that opened up the possibility that anyone could improve their lives with hard work and ambition. As we have built our wealth and power, we have also built our expectations. Ultimately, we need to settle down and accept that our expectations are rarely entitlements. Life is full of disappointments and failures.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid, love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Peace. here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me. You heard me, I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Slowly.
If people, myself included, are irritated by those who claim an entitlement to behave discourteously, what's the real harm? My irritation is my problem, not theirs. Aside from a diminished civility in society, there can be serious consequences. Consider the case of the Italian earthquake on April 6, 2009. The town of L'Aquila suffered 309 deaths and thousands of injured and homeless. The quake struck just hours before dawn, killing most in their beds. In September 2011, six experts and an official were placed on trial for manslaughter, accused of lulling the residents into a false sense of security. Vincenzo Vittorini is a surgeon who lost his wife and daughter in the quake. He describes the lead-up to the April 6th event.
Ad Aquila c'era uno sciame.
In L'Aquila, 6 months before the earthquake, a series of tremors began. A building in intensity and reaching a peak on March 30th, when there was a very violent tremor that scared everyone. Following that tremor on March 31, a meeting of the Great Risk Committee was convened, which is part of the Italian state whose purpose is to intervene and try to, let's say, aid the population when there are events that dangerous for the population. After that meeting, which lasted about 45 minutes, tranquilizing messages were given to the population.
Then chief of the technical division of the Civil Protection Agency, Bernardo Di Bernardini, is now one of the seven on trial because of statements like this.
The scientific community continues to assure me that it's actually a favorable situation because there's a continuous release of energy, hence there are these rather intense events, not incredibly intense, which is why we've seen just light damage given the drawn-out time frame. Therefore, I think we're ready to face the situation, and I ask the citizens to stand by us and stand by each other.
So in the meantime, we should all drink a good glass of wine?
Absolutely. A top Montepulciano.
Returning to the claims of the plaintiffs, as articulated by Vincenzo Vittorini, in translation.
We in L'Aquila knew that there could be an earthquake. Not one of this intensity were destructive, but after these tranquilizing words, which were repeatedly said by local authorities in the days followed, people were anesthetized. They took away our fear of earthquake. This was the cause of the tragedy of the night, because most people remain inside their homes. We think a civilized country like Italy must be able to, within the limits of possible, to protect its own people and assume its responsibility for what happened.
Di proteggere la propria gente. Allora, quello che è iniziato.
What began September 20th is a criminal trial in which the seven members of the Great Risk Committee are accused of manslaughter. This is a trial against men, not scientists. Men who should have interpreted signs and communicated things they were sure of. And if there was nothing they were sure of, then not to give false reassurances.
Gli scienziati, nel momento in cui hanno detto.
The moment in which this scientist said, don't worry, there won't be a major tremor, and that these tremors in fact released energy that was making a prediction, namely that there wouldn't be a violent earthquake. They shouldn't have done this. They should have taken into consideration the seismic nature of the area, the history of earthquakes, in fact, that it's the most seismic area in Italy. They should have communicated this to the population, and each of us would have evaluated our homes and decided to stay inside or sleep outside.
In essence, the case is not so much one of being entitled to infallible science, but one of entitlement to transparency in communication. Entitlement suggests that someone else bears the responsibility for satisfying one's needs and desires. In this case, the population is trying to hold people responsible for not telling them the whole story that would have enabled them to make fully informed decisions. There are challenges in determining just where the entitlement resides when it comes to information. The population of L'Aquila hold that they are entitled to the information under penalty of criminal prosecution. Most governments hold that they are entitled to keep secrets that they claim are needed for national security under penalty of criminal prosecution. Is maintaining calm, avoiding panic, a matter of national security? How about if there is a new disease that we don't know much about? Should the authorities tell people, who could easily respond with panic buying, staying home, shutting down an economy, or should the authorities hedge a little until they know enough to recommend a reasonable response? If people respond overly cautiously and the threat fails to materialize, would they be crying out for redress because they themselves opted to overreact? Whose fault is it? Who is entitled to what here? The idea of entitlement is big in politics. American budget problems with entitlement programs is almost daily news. The political right argues that offering people social programs is feeding a culture of entitlement, and the population will simply give up working, feeling entitled to be cared for by the state. In reality, people do not respond that way. There are many industrialized countries with extensive social safety nets, particularly in Europe. These countries are not unproductive. Their citizens still work hard and contribute to everyone's welfare. Next time in The Orb, I'll be looking at social inequality and its consequences. Where do you stand on your entitlements? Do you feel entitled to listen to The Orb for free? There are real out-of-pocket costs to producing The Orb: licenses, fees, servers, internet bandwidth. Whose responsibility is it to pay these expenses? Listeners that find value in The Orb? Are the producers entitled to make a profit from it? Let us know. Visit orbcast.ca and join in. There is an ancient Chinese proverb along the lines of, "From rags to riches and back again in three generations." I've heard a variant that made it four generations. Essentially, the first generation starts with next to nothing, the classic immigrant arriving with a cardboard suitcase and a dollar in his pocket who builds an empire. Raised during the initial growth of the family empire, the second generation experiences the hardships and sacrifices necessary to establish the roots of the family fortune. In their turn, they continue the effort and nurture that growth. The third generation grows up without the hardship, as the fortune is now providing well for the family. They see some of the work done by the second generation, but come their turn, they have little work left to do. This generation believes the family has earned the luxury and power they enjoy. Entitlement is starting to settle in. By the fourth generation, the memory and associated respect for the hardship and sacrifice that built the wealth is gone. From here, it is raw, unrestrained consumption. Entitlement is fully seated, and the wealth drains away. The money disappears, leaving only an unsated sense of entitlement. Our culture underwent tremendous hardship and sacrifice through the Depression of the 30s and the two world wars. That sacrifice led to an ethos that their children would have it better than they did. The second generation, the baby boomers, continued to develop the culture of amassing wealth and did their own share of the work, adding social reforms like the civil rights movement. The X generation inherited that legacy. They grew to enjoy the benefits and kept some respect for the price paid for them. Now we have a generation that has lost the memory of the Depression, the sacrifice of the wars, and the struggle for civil rights. We have taught them to be little more than consumers of goods and power. So they consume and expect to be able to consume without cost. They don't owe anyone anything. It was all paid for by the earlier generations.
I don't know if I should be defending our generation because I think they're pretty spoiled. Things just come way too easy these days.
We reap what we sow. From rags to riches and back again in three generations, or four. Do not be surprised that the cycle continues. We're just on the downward side of the loop. The Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornobile Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.